and running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
A wise man once said, "You don't choose the podcast chooses you." So consider yourself one of the chosen ones. Join us as we discuss books, masonry, esotericism, mysticism, lore, and more.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
In this episode, we discuss the 13th degree, the Royal Arch of Solomon. The night is dark, and the path is long. So join us, won't you, as we walk the way of the hermit.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Hello, Dave.
Hello, Gene. How's it going with you?
It is going good.
Good. Before we get started, I want to remind our listeners that show notes, chapter markers, and a transcript of this and all episodes are available on our website, wayofthehermit.com. In the previous degree, we became a master architect and the successor to Hiram Abiff. In this degree, the Royal Arch of Solomon, a major character is the biblical patriarch Enoch. In the myth of this degree, God communicates with Enoch in a dream. Gene, do you want to tell us about that dream?
In Enoch's dream, God revealed to him his true name. God took him to the top of a mountain and showed him his name. Then he took him down to the depths of the earth, and he was shown a vault of 9 arched chambers sunk vertically into the ground. The last vault contained a triangular plate of gold, and the name was there as well.
So Enoch ascended into the heavens and descended into the depths of the earth, and the name he saw written throughout creation was YHVH, or in Hebrew letters, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. That name is also called the Tetragrammaton, which means four-lettered name of God. It's usually translated into English as either Jehovah or Yahweh. So what did Enoch make out of this dream?
Enoch took this vision as a sign from God and set out on a long journey to find the place to construct this chamber.
Enoch knew that the true name of God was being forgotten. He's also told that the world may be destroyed, which is why he's trying to protect this treasure for future generations.
Right. He found a place and constructed the vault as he had received it in his vision. In the innermost chamber, he placed an alabaster pedestal and put upon it a cube of agate. Into one side of it was sunk a triangular plate of gold with the name of God. On top of the vaults, he built a modest temple out of unhewn stones. Ages passed, and the site of this place was lost to time. Much later, during the construction of Solomon's temple, there was a need of an administrative center. The site which was chosen was thought to be an old pagan temple, but was actually Enoch's old temple. Solomon charged Adoniram and 2 of his assistants, Jehu Abar and Setolkin. While clearing the site, they found a ring embedded in rock, and they pulled on it, and a secret passage was revealed. It was a dark vertical passage. They each took a turn, one being lowered by the other 2, 3 vertical chambers each, with Adoniram reaching the final chamber and discovering the treasure left by Enoch. The next day, they returned and removed the cube, which they brought immediately to King Solomon, who, upon seeing the name of the deity on the stone, recognized it, as his father David had conferred it to him. He then conveyed to the 3 the name of the Ineffable and the title of Masons of the 9th Royal Arch.
Solomon then confers this degree and the next degree of perfection on the Elus and the other master architects. But some of the Masons aren't very happy about being left out of the treasure, are they?
Right. There were some amongst the Master Masons who wanted the same titles and degrees as their fellows. They protested and were told, "Do the work, and in due time, rewards will follow."
That's the same story as the 3 ruffians who tried to get Master Hiram to reveal the word of a Master Mason. they were also told to wait until they'd done the work that qualifies them to receive it. So what happened next?
Most were satisfied, but 20 or so were not. So they took it upon themselves to storm the vault. While some of them went in, others did not, and observed flame and smoke and an explosion coming from the vault.
What happened?
The vault had collapsed.
What caused it to collapse?
In their insolence, they smashed the pillar in search of treasure.
Whoa. So they smashed the alabaster pedestal that held the cube.
Yeah.
They definitely didn't hold any of that place sacred. Before we move on into the chapter, I wanted to mention the article that you sent me that compared some of the symbolism of this degree to the map room scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That was from De Hoya's.
Yeah, it was called The Secrets of Enoch in the Masonic Tradition, and I've linked to it in the show notes. Are you ready to start into morals and dogma?
I think so.
What's your first quote?
Whether the legend and history of this degree are historically true, or but an allegory containing in itself a deeper truth and a profounder meaning, we shall not now debate. If it be but a legendary myth, you must find out for yourself what it means.
You have to find out for yourself, because it's the process of looking that creates the conditions for finding. Pike points out that the so-called secret name of God revealed in this degree appears hundreds of times in the Bible. So how can it be secret if it's right there?
Because it is truly ineffable. It is beyond words.
Which is the subject of the next section.
The ineffable name of God.
We touched on this in the last degree when we were given the name Adonai in Solomon's seal. The ineffable name of God that we're given in this degree, the Tetragrammaton, was not normally spoken by Jews when reading the Torah.
It was customary not to pronounce, quote-unquote, the name of God. They always just substituted Adonai.
But the legend is that the true pronunciation of that name was forgotten or lost. It is a matter of reverence, but also an acknowledgement of not knowing how to say it. The name is ancient Hebrew, and it doesn't specify the vowel placement, so maybe it's just a matter of trying all the different vowel combinations until one makes the heavens open up.
Yeah. Is there just a word that you can whisper in someone's ears and suddenly they're enlightened? Technically, I would say no. It doesn't matter what vowels you cram in between it, it's still ineffable, and that is incorrect.
Right. Pike points out that this inability to express this core religious concept is a theme in many world religions.
Yeah, it's a different expression in different cultures, but it's the same idea. It is very similar to how the Chinese ideal of the Tao is presented. The Tao that can be named is not the true Tao.
And the Hindu Om shares much of the symbolism of the Tetragrammaton, too. Every religion has to somehow address the paradox that underlies existence. We can't imagine something eternal, something that has no beginning or end, but that seems to be the case with how the universe is. Somehow self-existent, self-created. De Hoya has a footnote in this section from an Egyptian text called How Ra Came Into Being, which says, I am the creator of what hath come into being, and I myself came into being under the form of the god Khafre. And I came into being in primeval time. I uttered my own name from my own mouth as a word of power.
I am that I am.
Which was a name that God gave Moses. But all the names of God refer to this mystery. And you find this concept referred to in religions around the world.
Yeah, the mystery of existence and our place in it that transcends all cultures.
And even language itself. So what does it mean to communicate that name that isn't really a name to someone else?
It's kind of a nebulous thing, because how does one transfer other than like taking someone with their eyes concealed standing on the edge of the Grand Canyon, and then they open their eyes and they can see it and it overwhelms them.
That's a good analogy, but what if someone just isn't ready to receive the teaching?
You can take the horse to the water, but he has to be thirsty to drink.
Thirsty for what?
The truest sense of sacred, because that is what we've been building all along, is finding something sacred within.
which is what the true name refers to, but we get sidetracked because it's so easy to confuse the symbol for the thing it refers to. To quote Confucius, when a wise man points to the moon, the ignorant look at his finger.
Right. So it has always been that allegories, intended as vehicles of truth to be understood by the sages, have become or bred eras by being literally accepted.
Exactly. Symbols are our tools for knowing anything, but when you're talking about a concept as slippery as God, which represents something eternal and infinite, symbols are obstacles to our rational mind, which leads us to the subject of the next section.
Symbolism and the name of God. In this section, something that spoke to me was to lose or to forget the name of God is to lose your sense of the sacred, and you lose your way or you lose yourself. So finding the true name of God is finding the true sacred within.
And that symbol is personal to you. Here's a quote that speaks to that. The ancient symbols and allegories always had more than one interpretation. Thus, the pronunciation of the word was a symbol, and that pronunciation and the word itself were lost. When the knowledge of the true nature and attributes of God faded out of the minds of the Jewish people. That is one interpretation, true, but not the inner and most profoundest one. I thought that was an interesting statement. That isn't the most profound interpretation of that symbolism.
What did that mean to you?
That even if we use the same name, our sense of the sacred isn't the same, so we aren't talking about the same thing anyway. I mean, if you and I both use the word God, do you think we're talking about the same thing?
Theoretically, yes, but in the actual, no. Even if we use the same language, even then, it's open to interpretation. What I've learned in my language might not be what you've learned for your language, but in our heads, everything is different from everybody else's head.
What about the opposite stance? Could two different words actually represent the same thing? For example, God and Allah?
No, not in my mind.
Why not?
What is their definition of what something is? Your is always going to be different from my is.
Okay, hold it right there, Bill Clinton. What do you mean by that?
What I'm saying is that even if we think we're on the same parameters, it's always going to be flavored by what's in my head and what's in yours.
So you're just saying that those terms could never mean the same thing to you, not that they might not ultimately refer to the same thing.
Right. It doesn't matter what the symbol for that thing is.
It's always just a symbol.
And that's all we have.
So how many symbols for or names of God are there?
How many do you need?
Well, if God is the underlying unity, then in a sense, every name is an aspect of God, always limited, unlike what it refers to. I mean, isn't Gene really a name of God?
In certain circles, yes.
Oh, is that right? Well, let's cut right to the heart of that idea then. The next section is about idolatry. It's called Hebrew monotheism. What did you get from this section?
It's saying that the mass of Hebrews did not believe in the existence of only one God until a late period in their history.
Do you think he's talking about the seemingly tribal nature of God as described in the Torah?
Tribal, yeah.
I don't know if that's really true, because again, we're talking about allegories and symbols. But the idea behind his criticism is the question of how big you see God as. Just big enough to look out for your specific group, or one that runs everything?
The thing that condensed down for me was the statement of small minds have small gods. That's one of those, I don't know where it leaves me. It's like, I'm smarter, I have a better concept of God than you. That seems very arrogant and very misplaced.
I know what you mean by arrogant, because I think intellect can be as much of a hindrance as a help, especially when you're dealing with things that aren't purely rational. What do you mean by misplaced?
Well, I think he's trying to point out that God is not out there somewhere. God is within each and every one of us.
Some people might hear that as you saying, not joking this time, that you are God. How would you respond to that?
That is idolatry.
How so?
It's confusing the symbol with what the symbol points to. Apparently, it's a very human thing to do.
It is, and it goes back to a previous discussion we had about the greeting namaste, meaning I bow to you, with the implied reference to seeing God in you or through you. That expression isn't saying that that person is God, but that you see them as a living symbol of the transcendent.
Indeed.
That esoteric knowledge is part of the greater mysteries that Pike says Zoroaster, Mani, Confucius, Socrates, Plato, and Masonry communicate to their respective initiates, which is the subject of the next section. Masonry includes the communication of esoteric knowledge. So first, what is esoteric knowledge?
A secret that only you know. Knowledge of the heart.
That's good. I would add that it's a secret because it's personal to you and also ineffable, so it can't be communicated, except indirectly. Pike implies that this mode of transmission goes back to antiquity.
Pike does this wonderful little dance of Masonry is from the depths of time, but the actual history that we can look at is like, you know, from 1700 on.
Do you have a quote from here?
Yeah. By whatever name it was known in this or the other country, Masonry existed as it now exists, the same in spirit and at heart, not only when Solomon built the temple, but centuries before even the first colonies immigrated into southern India, Persia, and Egypt from the cradle of the human race.
So since there's not much historical support for that statement, what do you think he's saying?
I think it's pointing out the true essence of Masonry and how it relates to ancient rites is the basics, who we are and why we're here and how to live.
We touched on that common core of religions as being the unnameable unity, which this section describes as the supreme self-existent creator and preserver of the universe that was the same by whatever name he was called to the intellectual and enlightened people of all nations.
That quote continues with, the name was nothing, if not a symbol and representative hieroglyph of his nature and his attributes.
Again, that defines idolatry. It's not the symbol, it's what it points to, what it means. Do you have anything else from this section?
There's another quote there. To communicate the true and correct ideals in respect of the deity was one of the chief objects of the mysteries.
How does Masonry communicate these esoteric ideas about the deity?
The next section deals with that. Solomon's temple represented the universe. Solomon's temple is a teaching tool about God and the nature of the universe.
So how does this section say that it teaches those lessons?
Through the symbolic use of numbers.
Do you have a quote about some of the number symbolism of Solomon's temple?
Just a huge one in the middle about the Holy of Holies.
Go for it.
The Holy of Holies of the temple formed a cube in which was drawn on a plane surface. There are 9 lines visible and 3 sides or faces. It corresponded with the number 4 by which the ancients presented nature, it being the number of substances or corporeal forms and of the elements, the cardinal points and the seasons and the secondary colors.
The Holy of Holies is a cube, as is the New Jerusalem in Revelation, and in this degree, the cube of agate that has the true name of the deity written on it. As that quote made clear, the cube incorporates the numbers 9, 4, and 3. 4 is the number of earth and nature, and 3 is associated with heaven and deity. Here's a quote. The number 3 everywhere represented the supreme being, hence the name of the deity engraven upon the triangular plate. And that, sunken into the cube of agate, taught the ancient Mason and teaches us the true knowledge of God, of his nature, and his attributes.
That quote continues with, this knowledge of God, so written there, and of which Masonry has in all ages been the interpreter, is the Master Mason's word.
That says straight out that the true name of deity is the Master Mason's word.
So this would be a good time to throw in what the meaning of Enoch was.
Enoch lived 365 years, which associates him with the sun. His dream symbolically shows the ascent of the sun into the heavens and its apparent descent underneath the earth during the night.
The path of Ra.
Right. His name is also significant. In Hebrew, Enoch means teaching or initiation. We're being told that Enoch, as a representative of the sun, is the initiator of Masonry, and that the cube of agate contains the cornerstone of its philosophy. How would you interpret his dream in that light?
To reach ineffable, you must reach for the stars and deep within yourself.
Yes. The vault built by Enoch represents a place inside yourself. Here's a quote. By the subterranean vaults, you may understand the places of initiation, which in the ancient ceremonies were generally underground.
And where do all initiations truly take place? They take place within you.
Very true. Real initiations are esoteric events, which are mirrored by the symbols of the Masonic Lodge, which is the subject of the next section.
The Lodge represents the universe.
You described Solomon's Temple as a teaching tool. How does the Lodge fit into that scheme?
It's like a workroom for working out spiritual problems. The basic symbols are all right there in front of you to contemplate and to use for answers.
Our minds need symbols to manipulate to work out some types of problems. We've covered the symbols of the Lodge in previous episodes, so we won't repeat all of that. But just for an example here, Gene, what do the officers of the Lodge represent?
All the officers represent different aspects of yourself.
And as we've said, the officers represent aspects of the sun, too. Or you might even say aspects of Enoch.
Yeah.
What else did you have from this section?
I'm just going to read the quote. The lion that guarded the ark held in its mouth the key wherein to open it. It figuratively represents Solomon, the lion of the tribe of Judah, who preserved and communicated the key of true knowledge of God. What have you got on the lion with the key in its mouth besides that?
I think the lion is Isaac Luria, and the key is the Kabbalah. He was called the Ari, which in Hebrew means the lion, and his middle name, Ben Solomon, means son of Solomon. You know him, right?
Yeah. He's considered the father of modern Kabbalah and the subject of at least one Madonna song, Isaac.
That's right. And Madonna was married to Guy Ritchie, who we've talked about in a previous episode. Anyway, I've linked to information about Isaac Luria and his writings in the show notes. One other interesting note here is that Enoch means to teach and Kabbalah means to receive. So the lion with the key in its mouth is the Kabbalah as the key to opening the ark. And the key is found in the mouth, or in the words of the Ari, Isaac Luria. Okay, let's move on to the next section.
Preserving Liberty.
What do you have from this section?
It's very short, but it's pretty blunt. You can't just have liberty. It's an ongoing trust. The first statement, it is not enough for a people to gain its liberty. It must secure it. It must not entrust the keeping or hold it at the pleasure of any one man.
Outwardly, this section is about the Constitution, written laws, and orders of succession. Here's a quote. The keystone of the royal arch of the great temple of liberty is a fundamental law, charter, or constitution, the expression of the fixed habits of thought of the people embodied in a written instrument. The same in war as in peace, that cannot be hastily changed nor be violated with impunity, but is sacred like the Ark of the Covenant of God, which none could touch and live. The point here is that just like you should personally rely on principles and not just sentiment to guide your actions, societies need to write down laws and then abide by them to preserve liberty. In particular, Pike points out how dangerous it is to violate or compromise the Constitution for any reason whatsoever, which should serve as a warning to our age, which seems perfectly willing to do that for short-term safety and personal security.
It's truly the age of the crowned and conquering child.
It is. One more thing from this section. We're told that Hiram symbolizes human liberty. So the esoteric reading of this section is that we're actively participating in the preservation of liberty by passing through the degrees which were written down in order for there to be a smooth succession to replace Hiram. Liberty shouldn't die with Hiram, and it shouldn't be confined to the Lodge, as we discuss in the next section.
The religion of toil, life, and society.
Do you have a quote from this section?
Yeah. Referring to masonry, it teaches that everything is beautiful in its time, in its place, in its appointed office, that everything which man is put to do, if rightfully and faithfully done, naturally helps to work out his salvation.
That is the theme of this section. Everything in life can teach us if we let it. Here's a quote. The appointed action of life is the great training of providence, and if man yields himself to it, he will need neither churches nor ordinances, except for the expression of his religious homage and gratitude.
Yeah, I thought that one was profound. The oracles of God do not speak from the pulpit alone. You don't do spiritual time as a down payment and then go on with the rest of your life. It is something that exists in your life at every moment.
Right. I think that artificial separation is sometimes a block for people. You know, you do your time at church or wherever your spiritual happy place is and then go back to quote-unquote real life.
So what do you think the phrase, I'm a spiritual person, but I'm just not that religious, what do you think that means?
I think that phrase is often said as a response to a sense of being manipulated or controlled by organized religion, but on a deeper level, I think it often means that a person thinks and talks about spirituality, but actually has no real religious beliefs or practices. So, in effect, it's something people say to soothe their conscience, I think. I've probably said that in the past, too. Masonry does push you, though, to put those principles into practice, which is the subject of the next section.
On the religious nature of masonry.
I thought masonry was not a religion.
Well, what he tries to convey in this, I think, is that the heart of masonry is the core of religion. Both rely on the core nature of the sacred. This is the true religion revealed to the ancient patriarchs, which masonry has taught for many centuries, and which it will continue to teach as long as time endures. A mason's great business with life is to read the book of its teaching, to find that life is not the doing or the drudgeries, but the hearing of oracles.
That's a great quote. I only have one from this section. Ever the soul reaches outward and asks for freedom. It looks forth from the narrow and grated windows of sense upon the wide, immeasurable creation. It knows that around it and beyond it lie outstretched the infinite and everlasting paths. That quote made me think of Blake and Huxley and the Doors of Perception.
Break on through to the other side.
Yeah. Or in this case, to the last section.
On the law of retribution.
What do you have from this section?
Oh, man. The quote. The law of retribution presses upon every man, whether he thinks of it or not. It pursues him through all the courses of his life with a step that never falters nor tires, and with an eye that never sleeps. If it were not so, God's government would not be impartial. There would be no discrimination, no moral dominion, no light shed upon the mysteries of providence.
What does that say to you?
You can't cheat divine providence. It is the all-seeing eye that follows you always. It's, again, natural law. For everything you do, there's a cost. I mean, it's straight and to the point. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he reap.
That law of retribution is at work within us, too. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to trust our conscience as a basis for judgment. Here's my last quote. Our moral, like our mental character, is not formed in a moment. It is the habit of our minds, the result of many thoughts and feelings and efforts bound together by many natural and strong ties. Each thought, each feeling, each action, each event, every passing hour, every breathing moment, all are contributing to form the character according to which we are to be judged.
Every breath you take, every move you make.
That what you're doing at every moment contributes to what you will be is uncomfortable to think about, but as a master architect, you're supposed to take responsibility for all of your actions. The truth is that you're actually sacrificing your time on the altar of the thing you think, talk, and do the most, and you will receive the fruits of that labor.
Bow down before the one you serve. You're going to get what you deserve. Trent Reznor.
We'll let that quote serve as a summary of the law of retribution. That's all for the chapter in Morals and Dogma. Let's end with a discussion of the symbols of the degree. I'll start off here with a quote. In this degree, you will witness a symbolic descent into the earth, where the remains of a temple are discovered. It may represent the self-exploration each of us must make in our quest for truth. Self-discovery was the purpose of all true ancient initiations. Hence, the Greeks adorned their temples with the words, "Know thyself." So the dream of Enoch is an allegory of self-discovery. Let's go through its symbolism in detail. Gene, would you start us off?
Enoch went to the top of the mountain and to the depths of the earth, and he saw the same name written across all of it.
Enoch engraved that word on a triangular plate, embedded it into a cube of agate, and hid it deep within the earth because he knew that the name of God was going to be lost and wanted to preserve it.
Right.
We've explained how the word inscribed on the cube is the name that isn't a name, that symbolizes the unnameable unity at the core of all religions. In this degree, we've called that word the true name of God and the Master Mason's word. Do you remember waiting to be initiated into the Scottish Rite? There was something written on the wall there. Do you remember?
On the wall of the Chamber of Reflection, Vitrol, V-I-T-R-I-O-L.
Yes, that's an acronym for a Latin phrase.
It translates into visit the interior of the earth, and by rectifying what you find there, you will discover the hidden stone.
And that hidden stone is the cube of agate.
That's the Philosopher's Stone or the Ashlar?
It's both. Listen to these lines from the Emerald Tablet of Hermes that describes the Philosopher's Stone. That which is below is like that which is above, and that which is above is like that which is below to do the miracles of the one thing. That's the unnameable unity.
Okay.
It ascends from the earth to the heaven, and again it descends to the earth. There's Enoch's dream. He saw the name written in the heavens, and he saw it written in the depths of the earth.
Right.
And the Emerald Tablet ends with, that which I have said of the operation of the sun is accomplished and ended. Enoch is associated with the sun and its movements.
That's good.
So the cube of agate is the philosopher's stone of alchemy, and as the Master Mason's word, it's the foundation of Masonic philosophy.
The cornerstone.
Yes. So what do we need to do to find this hidden stone?
You start digging. Well, they didn't dig. They found the secret entrance.
That's right. They knew where to start looking, and we do too. You don't need to go to Oak Island. It's inside ourselves. But to find it, they did have to clear a path.
They had to move the debris to find the hidden way.
For this analogy, let's say the debris represent the accumulations of all the things that have happened to you during your life that have hidden the sacred from you. It's things about yourself, some that you've hidden from yourself, some that you really, really may not want to know. Have you ever heard that old saying that God will never give you more than you can handle?
Yeah.
My friend Ed Francisco used to say that the graveyards, prisons, and insane asylums tell a different story.
That's very Irish.
Yeah. The point there is that people can become overwhelmed and lose their way, their minds, and even their lives. It relates to this discussion because if you're seriously trying to know yourself and what reality is, you can end up in some pretty dark places if you don't have a good foundation to start with. And I'm speaking from personal experience there. And that is the allegory of the Masons who stormed the vault and were killed when it collapsed.
A cautionary tale of ignorance, something that you find that your mind cannot handle. Literally a mental breakdown.
Seeing something about yourself or others that's difficult to integrate is one cause of calamity. The one described in the story, though, sounds more like they were trying to skip past the work they needed to do to authorize them to the esoteric knowledge. And part of that work was to understand what sacred means. Their own actions showed they weren't qualified. They smashed the alabaster pedestal looking for material treasure. So what were they lacking?
That sense of awe, that sense of everything is sacred.
Do you ever have those kind of feelings?
Brief moments.
I think there was a time when we all felt like that, but we just don't remember it. It was before we became who we are now. When you're a kid, everything is mythic, which is both good and bad. But anyway, something happened that washed that innocent world away.
You're talking about puberty.
I am, because our entire focus changes. You might say you get kicked out of Eden.
Yeah, suddenly they realized they were naked.
Exactly. And that longing paired with shame and all the things that happen as a result are the debris that keep us from finding the light. It's in there. It's just clouded over by years of association with the world.
It's literally your soul before the world.
It is. You're trying to recover a connection to that untainted, innocent part of you that doesn't feel unworthy, is still capable of feeling awe, and has an instinctive connection to life.
Trying to find our way back home. You must become like a child to enter the kingdom of heaven.
Amen, brother. I have just one more thing. The cube of agate, which we're saying now is the Philosopher's Stone, it's a perfect 10-inch cube. What does 10 represent?
10 fingers, 10 toes. Completion.
So it's the completed and perfect ashlar. Do you remember the DeHoyas footnote that confounded us earlier about the perfect ashlar?
It was found, not made.
And here in this degree, we found it. And because it's the perfect ashlar, it's the standard to compare yourself against. It's the pure you, not corrupted by the world. The triangular pedestal that the stone sits on is white.
Alabaster.
Right, but the cube is an agate, so even if it is white, it isn't purely white.
So you're saying that the agate is a mixture of stones?
It's a mixture of colors. It has striations, so even if it is white, it's not pure white. That seems significant to me and ties back to the idea that it needs to be rectified. So maybe the concepts we have here need to be purified before it becomes the white stone? Anyway, Gene, will you close us out here with a passage by one of the patron saints of Masonry, St. John of Patmos?
Revelation chapter 2, verse 17. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit said unto the churches. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the hidden manna, and will give him a white stone, and in the stone a new name is written, which no man knoweth, saving he that receiveth it.
That's it. What are we doing next time?
In the next episode, we discuss the 14th degree, perfect Elu.
So, I'm David.
And I'm Gene.
Join us next time as we continue our exploration of Morals and Dogma, the annotated edition.
As we walk the way of the hermit.